Welcome to today's program titled 2016 National Year in Review, What You Need to Know About the Recent Cases and Developments in Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud Law. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Michael Wexler. You may begin.
Thank you, Donna. Good morning and good afternoon to you, depending on what part of the country you're in. We have folks logged in from all over the country, and welcome. Today, myself, along with Robert Milligan and Josh Salinas, we will go through what happened in 2016 with regard to interesting new relevant developments in the trade secret area, the non-compete area, computer fraud, and various legislation associated with that. So without further ado, we will, let's see. Here's our legal disclaimer, which we need to tell you that we are essentially not giving you legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances, and the content here is for general information purposes only, and you're urged to consult an attorney concerning your own situation, any specific legal questions that you may have. Specifically, what we're going to cover, we're going to talk about the Defend Trade Secrets Act. That's probably one of the most interesting, most relevant, and somewhat industry-changing enactment with regard to trade secrets by actually having a federal trade secret statute now that folks can use to bring claims throughout the United States, and in particular can be used with regard to foreign companies, and we'll get into more detail about that. Well, next we'll talk a little bit about the EU and a directive issued from the EU with regard to this area of trade secrets. After that, we will talk to you about government agencies that are having more and more interest in and scrutinizing the scope of non-disclosure and restrictive covenant agreements. And as a result of that, there are various requirements that need to be met with regard to employment agreements, non-compete agreements, confidentiality agreements, handbooks, equity agreements, depending on what you put in those. So it's an important topic, and we'll let you know what's going on in that area. Then we'll talk about other new state legislation with regard to restrictive covenants, as well as cases around the country with interesting or relevant or important decisions in this area. Next, we'll have a discussion about forum selection clauses, because this has become a big deal, certainly since late 2013 with the advent of the Supreme Court's decision in Atlantic Marine, and recently with California enacting a statute that doesn't permit, actually outlaws within non-compete agreements, choice of law and venue provisions entered into or amended after January 1st. And does have a safe harbor that needs to be filed in order to do that. And then finally, we'll have a discussion about security breaches and data theft and things that happened during the last year that are relevant to that topic. So let's first talk about the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And as you can see in front of you, that was signed by President Obama in May of 2016 because, as many of you might know, there were approximately 48 states in the country that had trade secret statutes that were in one way or another based upon the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, but there was still no federal cause of action that was available for private litigants with regard to trade secret misappropriation. There was certainly a federal criminal statutes under the Economic Espionage Act that the federal government could use for these types of cases, but no federal statute that was available to private litigants to make these claims. So the statute now provides the opportunity to bring claims under a federal statute, a federal question, which gets you into federal court, without having to have some of the prerequisites that were previously required if you were bringing a claim under a state law claim. So now you can, unless there was diversity, there was no jurisdiction federally, but now you have another hook that you can bring a claim in federal court. And we'll get into the specifics of the statute momentarily. And most importantly, we'll talk about specific language that the statute requires. And this is probably the most important thing, one of, if not the most important thing to take out of today's webinar, is that if you have agreements, if you have handbooks, if you have equity awards that you use with employees, either new employees or agreements that folks enter into, there is language that is required under the DTSA that without it, you're not entitled to get certain punitive damages and attorney's fees. So it's incumbent upon we would suggest that it's incumbent upon businesses to take a look at these types of agreements, these types of documents, and make sure that they are certainly compliant with the Defend Trade Secrets Act, so you're not limiting your ability to address the situation, as well as you'll see from some of the other legislation and statutes that we'll talk about. There's other changes that would likely be considered by many of you with regard to your documents. The Federal Trade Secrets Act, the Defend Trade Secrets Act, gets rid of inconsistencies and differences from state to state, whereas many states are based upon the Uniform Trade Secrets Act and their own statutes. There's still nuances to each state with regard to their trade secret statutes. So now with one federal act, that brings some uniformity to that. This is a long time in the coming. It was something that folks had tried to get through Congress and get the president to sign previously, but now it has actually happened. And so now we have the opportunity to use this statute. So what is it about the statute that's interesting? What is it that you should know? The biggest thing is that there are remedies under the Defend Trade Secrets Act that aren't necessarily or haven't necessarily been available and certainly not available in a uniform format. So, for example, under the DTSA, you are entitled to get injunctive relief. And with regard to that injunctive relief, it allows a person to get relief to protect trade secrets, but it doesn't necessarily allow a court to issue an injunction that would stop a person from being employed by a competitor. That's a topic that's covered by non-competes. It's not a trade secret issue. So what happens is that the injunctive relief from the DTSA at this point is seen as a way for a court to fashion relief that protects trade secrets that may impose certain limitations on the employment relationship. It may impose certain limitations on what a person could do in order to protect trade secrets, but it certainly isn't, it isn't panacea that, oh my gosh, you can bring this claim and stop someone from working at a competitor. That's certainly not the case. Then the DTSA also provides for actual damages, exemplary damages, which is up to 2 times the amount of actual damages, which is not an uncommon formula that we see in a lot of the state acts. And then certainly allows for attorney's fees with willful malicious finding or if a claim is brought in bad faith, which of course that's very similar to many state statutes. Again, another way to look at this is that the statute also provides for reasonable royalty, which again is very similar to state statutes. So the Defend Trade Secret Act also has a 3-year statute of limitations. And of course, that starts like many statute of limitations when a particular harm is discovered, or in this case, misappropriation, or when it actually occurred or when it's discovered. And of course, there can always be an issue with regard to when someone knew or should have known. So that certainly comes into play here. The statute also provides for ex parte seizures, which is not uncommon in trade secrets cases at the state level, but the statute specifically says only in extraordinary circumstances that particular remedy can be used. And then you have the requirements as to how you can obtain a ex parte order. And with regard to that, as you can see on your screen, the harm to the applicant for the injunction, the ex parte injunction, the harm is greater to that person and outweighs the harm to the person whom against the seizure sought. And in order to achieve obtaining an ex parte injunction, the applicant would need to show that the information is actually a trade secret, that it's worthy of protection, reasonable efforts have been taken, and that this is one of, if not the only, ways to protect the information by taking this immediate ex parte action. And so you would have to, of course, show that the information is misappropriated through improper means, or folks that conspire to use improper means to misappropriate the trade secret at issue. So those are the requirements with regard to obtaining the ex parte relief. So then, as we talked about a moment ago, that the statute requires a certain information to be in new agreements, there's language that has to alert folks under this provision of the Defense Trade Secrets Act with regard to what we call whistleblower immunity provision. And what that is in short, it is a safe harbor to not expose a person to liability if they disclose a trade secret in certain situations. And those situations include providing information to a government official or providing that information to an attorney that one is seeking advice from, or it's done, of course, within the context of making a report with regard to a violation of the law. So it basically encourages people to be able to report and speak to folks about wrongdoing, certain limited folks, but without the fear of having liability for that activity. What it does then is the Act specifically requires that you put notice of this immunity into the agreement, into a handbook, into policies. And specifically, it says any contract or agreement with an employee that governs the use of a trade secret or other confidential information must have this provision, and we'll show you what that is in a moment. With regard to being in compliance, we've certainly come up with language. The statute doesn't give you exact language that must be used, but it certainly requires that an employer give notice, and that the employer provides what's called a cross-reference to a policy that's given to the employee that lays out the specific provisions, and you can't get exemplary damages or attorney's fees if you don't have this language. So the one thing to note with regard to this, we put it in blue here so you wouldn't miss it, the definition of an employee is drafted very broadly. So it's possible that this notice may also be required with regard to a contractor or a consultant, someone who's not necessarily an employee, someone who's potentially a 1099, but until there's further interpretation, courts could differ with regard to that meaning, but it's certainly drafted very broadly, so it would be wise potentially to actually put this language in all agreements with anyone that you're working with. As we've said, you need to put this language in things. And so, for example, if you have a non-disclosure agreement, this language should be in it. If you have some kind of standard agreements, you should put this language in it. If you have a handbook, you should put this language in it. The benefit is great if the language is in. If you were in a situation to have to enforce these agreements with regard to disclosures of trade secrets or confidential information, and the downside, of course, is great because you don't have the opportunity for exemplary damages or for attorney's fees. So it's strongly encouraged that agreements be adjusted with regard to this. The magic language with regard to the trade secrets immunity is, again, around the idea that the employees encouraged to report criminal activity, improper activity, without the fear of liability or retaliation. So what we've come up with, here's an example. Immunity: an individual should not be held criminally or civil liable under the federal or state trade secrets law for the disclosure of a trade secret that is made in confidence to federal, state, or local government official, either directly or indirectly, or to an attorney, and solely for the purpose of reporting or investigating a suspected violation of law, or is made in a complaint or other document filed in lawsuit or other proceeding if such filing is made under seal. This is language we came up with. This isn't necessarily, you need to do this exactly this way, but this is the language. This is just an example of what one might consider. One might consider also language that says use of a trade secret information in an anti-retaliation lawsuit. Individual who files a lawsuit for retaliation by an employer for reporting a suspected violation of law may disclose a trade secret to the attorney of the individual and use the trade secret information in the court proceeding if the individual files any document containing the trade secret under seal and does not disclose the trade secret except pursuant to court order. So at this point, I think we'll turn things over to, Josh is next, who will start talking about the EU Trade Secrets Directive. And I just want to remind folks that if you have any questions, we'll certainly provide time for questions at the end, but you can also type in a question on your screen, and we'll try to answer those questions during the presentation as well.
Thanks, Michael. This is actually Robert. I'm going to take over for now. Just wanted to highlight a few things about the DTSA. This really was a monumental year for trade secret and non-compete attorneys because we had the passage of the Defend Trade Secret Act, which is now allowing companies to be in federal court for trade secret claims. And then we also saw a significant amount of activity on statutes being passed to regulate non-competes. And we had guidance from the former Obama administration. They really made a push to narrow and circumscribe the use of non-competes by employers. And so that's some of the information that I'm going to cover in my portion of today's presentation. I did want to highlight a few things for the audience about the Defend Trade Secret Act. Now we're beginning to see some cases coming out from the Federal District Court interpreting the Defend Trade Secret Act. Now, some of the issues that we're seeing are, the concept of continuing misappropriation. And essentially that means a situation of where there was misappropriation before the statute was passed, but there continues to be misappropriation. So let's say there's some theft of electronic files that occurred prior to the statute being passed, and then those files are continuing to be accessed and used after the statute was passed, and whether you can avail yourself of the Defend Trade Secret Act. And in general, it appears that there's beginning to become such of a majority rule on that issue that you could maintain a claim for the misappropriation acts that occurred past the passage of the statute. There's a doctrine of continuing misappropriation and not allowing companies to pursue such claims and basically starting the clock ticking when the first act of misappropriation occurred. But it appears that in some of the cases that have come out that they're actually allowing the DTSA claims to proceed, particularly for the acts that occurred post-passage of the statute. Another development that we're seeing under the DTSA cases are injunctions being issued for misappropriation of trade secrets, actual or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets. There has been some attempts to enforce the ex parte seizure order, which is very extraordinary remedy that we haven't seen before and involves the use of federal marshals to actually acquire the misappropriated property and a hearing before the judge. And the real significance of this is that the defendant doesn't even know about the lawsuit and doesn't even know about the ex parte seizure order until the federal marshal comes knocking on their door. And we've seen some attempts to get these types of extraordinary orders. There haven't been any that we've seen that have been successful thus far, but it remains to be seen how much, how used this this ex parte seizure order provision will be. And I just point out to you that we have a dedicated page on our website that tracks the new decisions under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And so that's something that, you know, we're dedicated to keep our clients informed of the latest and greatest as it relates to the Defend Trade Secrets Act. With that, let's change to the other side of the pond. The same time that the Defend Trade Secret Act was passed, our friends on the other side of the Atlantic in Europe, they also passed a trade secret directive. And essentially what that's going to do is harmonize trade secret law in the EU. Up to that point, no legal framework existed for the protection of trade secrets throughout the EU. And in the spring of 2016, there was the passage and the adoption of this new directive. And now the EU member states have a period of 24 months to adopt a national legislation that meets certain standards of protection for trade secrets. Some of the key points of the directive are that it provides a uniform definition of a trade secret. It also provides conduct that is unlawful with respect to the use of trade secrets, that is also supposed to be uniform. And then it, similarly to the United States, it creates a whistleblower defense to trade secret misappropriation claims. And as indicated under the slide there, EU member countries have 24 months to enact national laws that are in accord with this directive. It puts a limit on the statute of limitations. It cannot exceed 6 years. So member countries have some flexibility as how long the statute of limitations will be on trade secret claims, but it cannot exceed 6 years. And then they also provide some minimal rules for protection and preservation of trade secrets during litigation. And that can be very significant because when you get into the public courts, obviously you have concerns with respect to the disclosure of trade secret information, and the particular directive provides protections for companies so that they can protect their trade secrets while at the same time pursue claims against people that misappropriate their trade secrets. And this is a real market sea change in providing some uniformity and some precision as it relates to protecting information in the EU. And often this is a important concern for multinational companies that are trying to grasp the concept of having a non-disclosure agreement with their employees throughout the world. And this is really going to help companies have some clarity as far as putting together a sort of a model non-disclosure agreement. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to have a universal non-disclosure agreement that you can use with all your employees throughout the world, but it'll give you a lot more clarity in being able to craft an enforceable type of an agreement. Next topic I'd like to turn to, and I alluded to it, is that the Obama administration really made a push to move forward with some non-compete reform. And this went hand in hand with their support of the Trade Secret, Defend Trade Secret Act. And I think the perspective there was, yes, it's legitimate for companies to protect their trade secrets and they should be able to avail themselves of federal court. That being said, there was a concern, I believe, that companies were misusing non-competes and asking lower-level employees to sign non-competes. And there was a perspective, at least from the Obama administration, that there should be some reforms there. And they really focused on three main points. And it was worth noting that they actually used our non-compete 50-state guide as a reference to show what the current state of the law was with respect to non-competes. And of course, that 50-state guide is available to all you on this call. Now, the three main areas that this paper that the Obama administration put out detailed was, number one, they wanted to ban non-competes for categories of workers, workers beyond a certain wage threshold, workers in the occupations that promote public health and safety, and workers who are unlikely to possess trade secrets or workers who may service adverse impacts from non-compete, such as workers terminated without cause. The second main point of the call for reform was to improve transparency and fairness of non-competes, for example, by disallowing non-competes unless they are proposed before a job offer or significant promotion has been accepted, and providing consideration over and above continued employment. And then also encouraging employers to better inform workers about the law in their state and the existence of non-compete contracts and how they work. And then lastly, the main key point from this report was also to incentivize employers to write enforceable contracts and encourage the elimination of unenforceable provisions. For example, the promotion of a red pencil doctrine, which would render contracts with unenforceable provisions void in their entirety. So that was, you know, the Obama administration's real push before the end of the year. Now, whether this reform movement will have any traction with the Trump administration remains to be seen. If I was a betting person, I would say probably not. But I think that the significance of this reform movement is that it really highlights some of the key issues that go on in the state and federal courts when you're trying to enforce non-competes. Issues such as whether the court will blue pencil the agreement, that is, strike offending provisions but enforce other aspects of the non-compete, or whether it's really an all or nothing proposition. Other key issues such as consideration and whether continued employment would be sufficient for the non-compete. And then also sort of the scope of the workforce that you ask to sign non-competes. All these types of issues that were highlighted in the Obama administration's call for reform, these are played out on a daily basis in our courts as far as workers and employers that hire employees with non-competes, as far as some of the arguments that they try to leverage. And certainly, I think it makes companies that use non-competes, it makes them step back and really think about what can we do, what should we be putting in our agreement to make it more enforceable in light of these, in light of this movement, and in light of the fact that in general, courts try to really narrowly circumscribe non-competes. Another key thing that came out last year that we'd like to highlight is that the Department of Justice and the FTC, they issued some guidance regarding antitrust laws in the employment context and how it's significant with respect to today's presentation is that guidance explains how antitrust law applies to employee hiring and compensation practices. And in a nutshell, it really focuses on some practices that they were trying to circumscribe. Agreements among employers to limit or fix the compensation paid to employees or to refrain from soliciting or hiring each other's employees are per se violations of the antitrust laws, according to this guidance provided by the DOJ and the FTC. And so even competitors that don't explicitly agree to limit or suppress compensation, the mere exchange of compensation information among employers may violate antitrust laws if it has the effect of suppressing compensation. And so this was some clear messaging and some clear design guidance to HR professionals to try to prohibit, you know, that type of sharing of information amongst competitors, and also to try to discourage agreements between competitors to not solicit or hire others' employees. And we're seeing a tremendous amount of action in California, particularly amongst technology companies who are getting dinged by the plaintiff's bar for having these types of arrangements with competitors. And you're looking at settlements in excess of $100 million, some even in excess of $300 million. And so these are really a no-no when it comes to agreements between competitors. So it's something to red flag for your management team. It seems like these agreements would be benign, but they are not, and it really has gotten the ire of the Justice Department. Whether there will be some loosening with respect to the Trump administration kind of remains to be seen. There probably will be, but it's also this is going to continue to be an issue that companies are going to have to deal with until the DOJ and the Trump administration tells us that it's not an issue. Also continuing to see a lot of activity via the NLRB last year, and this is significant because what they're really trying to do is not only in your non-disclosure agreements and your employee handbooks, but also just in documents that you may provide to employees about what they can and can't do with respect to the disclosure of confidential information. The NLRB is really focusing in on providing clarity and examples to employees about what is allowable and what is not allowable. And to the extent your policy is broad and ambiguous and really tries to capture information that is protected under the NLRB, information regarding employees' own compensation information regarding their own working conditions, to the extent that your policy could be construed as limiting the disclosure of that information, the NLRB is aggressively pursuing companies, and that's what they did in the Quicken Loans case. I'd like to turn now to highlight some new non-compete laws that came up this year. In four instances, the legislation actually passed, and in the other instance, it was not passed, but there continues to be a movement to get that non-compete reform through. Number one, in Utah, now there is a limitation on the duration of non-competes with employees in Utah. It used to be that employers would include 18 months up to 2 years, but now there's a strict strict line that you can only have a non-compete for 1 year in the typical employment context. And also, under Utah law, it doesn't provide for blue penciling, so you need to be correct and reasonable in the drafting of your agreement, so that if you draft an agreement that is overly broad, hoping that the court will reform that agreement, the court will not do so under this new statute. Now Oregon limited the duration of non-competes as well, and they actually limited it, I believe, to 18 months. The slide is indicating 2 years, but I believe that it indicated that they've limited it to 18 months. Also, with respect to physician non-competes, there was some limiting of the use of those non-competes in Connecticut and Rhode Island. Now, in Connecticut, they limited the duration and geographical scope of those non-competes. Rhode Island went for a complete ban of non-competes. There continues to be a movement in Massachusetts, which is one of the lone holdouts, along with New York, to adopt the Uniform Trade Secret Act. There's also a movement in Massachusetts to circumscribe the use of non-competes and make it more like California, which is always something that employers are their ears open when they hear that. And to date, they have not been successful, but there's always a movement to do so. And then there was legislation recently introduced in the Massachusetts legislature to again limit or ban the use of non-competes. And we closely track those issues on our blog, so if you're interested, feel free to look into that. Lastly, with my time, I'd like to highlight for you some notable trade secret cases and non-compete cases that came about this year. And Josh and myself, we put together a top developments piece that we highlight what has occurred in non-compete law this year. And these are some of the cases that we thought were significant. And I think they're significant because they also highlight what really occurs in trade secret and non-compete cases and things that employers have to keep in mind when they pursue such claims. The first case is a case based out of Texas before the Texas Supreme Court, and it had to do with the situation of whether you can keep the defendant's company representative out of the hearing before the judge when there's a hearing. And the concern obviously there is that the plaintiff doesn't want the competitor to know about their trade secrets. And that's often a sticky wicket because the courts are supposed to be open forums and for public consumption. Now, in this particular case, the Texas Supreme Court ruled that under the Texas newly enacted Uniform Trade Secret Act, the court does have discretion to exclude a company representative from hearings involving trade secret information. And it's really a balancing test as to whether or not that's appropriate or not. The court further held that a party has no absolute constitutional due process right to have a designated representative present at the hearing. Now, I think that the upshot of this decision is really going to be a case-by-case decision about whether the court is actually going to exclude the other side from hearing testimony regarding the trade secret. The statute obviously provides that that can occur for in-camera, you know, review of the trade secret information. But this is something that companies often overlook, is that when you do pursue a trade secret claim, there is likely going to be a public hearing, and it's ultimately going to be up to the judge about whether he's going to exclude the media, whether he's going to exclude members of the public, if he's going to exclude the competitors from the hearing. So it's something to keep in mind when you're trying to aggressively pursue a trade secret case. And often I've seen situations where the judges use that uncertainty about whether he will exclude, he or she will exclude the public or the media or competitors from the hearing as an anvil to force the parties to settle. So it's one thing to keep in mind there. Another significant decision out of Kansas, under the Kansas Uniform Trade Secret Act, the court found that payments to a forensic expert did not satisfy the showing of actual loss caused by misappropriation. And that can be significant because that can be outcome determinative if you don't otherwise have damages to pursue your trade secret claim. And the other side can argue that this is a no damages case and the case should be dismissed. Oftentimes you like to use your forensic fees, you know, in pursuing your investigation as a basis to show that you actually have damages and be able to stay in court. But this particular court found that payments to forensic experts did not satisfy that actual loss requirement under the statute. Now, courts go different ways on this, but this is a key issue to keep in mind, particularly if you have that trade secret case where you're looking for injunctive relief and you haven't lost customers yet. And so the other side is always trying to rattle their saber that this is no damages in the court, you know, that it's not right. Another case out of Texas, a significant case. In that particular case, there was no showing that the employer had sustained any damages. In fact, the jury found that there was no damages, but still awarded attorney's fees in the neighborhood of $2.8 million. And you could say, well, how is that even possible? But at least according to this Texas appellate court, there was claims for injunctive relief, and there was claims for lost profits. Ultimately, they weren't able to be successful on their claim for lost profits. They were successful in part on their claim for injunctive relief, and so the court was okay in awarding the attorney's fees. And then another new case that came up, and this has to do with the new Defend Trade Secret Act. It was a defense brought by the employee who had purloined a large box and bag of company information. And he tried to justify his theft of that information by saying, you know, he was taking documents to support whistleblower claims against his company. And there was not a strong factual showing as to why he believed he was a whistleblower and why the information in question would be, you know, protected by this whistleblower immunity defense. And the court rejected that defense on a motion to dismiss brought by the employee. So I think you're going to see more cases under the Defend Trade Secret Act where they try to leverage, the defendant tries to leverage a defense that, yeah, I may have taken some stuff, but that was because I want to pursue my whistleblowing claims against the company. And yeah, maybe I took some competitive information, but that was either accidental or that was to justify my whistleblower claim. So I think it's a liar's argument, but I think you'll be seeing more of those types of defenses as we get more case law under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. There were some significant restrictive covenant cases this year as well. I think the most notable, and particularly for those that are responsible for drafting non-compete agreements for their company or at least making them updated, Big development in Nevada. Nevada rejected the blue pencil rule, which is very significant because now you have to make sure that your agreement is right. If it's overly broad and unreasonable, the court will throw out the entire agreement with respect to the non-compete. So, if you were of the mindset, well, let's draft this large and see if the court will, you know, pare it down, that's not going to work in Nevada under Nevada law. So you're going to want to make sure that your agreement, you know, comports with Nevada law if you have employees there. Significant case out of Tennessee, the court found that the restrictive covenants were unenforceable where the employer had not provided employee with any confidential or specialized training. That's a significant issue that comes up in restrictive covenant cases. Just because you have a non-compete, you're going to have to show that you have a legitimate business interest. Often employers point to specialized training. Oftentimes employers point to exposure to trade secrets and confidential information. But just a non-complete, a stark non-compete with no legitimate business interest justifying it, oftentimes you're not going to get any relief, particularly in Tennessee. Texas is another jurisdiction where that's a concern as well, and Colorado. Interesting, a pro-employer decision in Ohio, where they upheld the non-compete, giving the former employer discretion to determine whether the ex-employee is working for a competitor. Typically, the courts like to see a lot of certainty in the agreement and not a lot of conditional actions that need to occur in the future if they're going to enforce a non-compete. But this particular non-compete gave the former employer discretion on who they deemed to be a competitor, and the court was willing to enforce it. So that was a sort of a pro employer decision, depending on what side of the V you're on. And another decision, significant decision that came out of Massachusetts, where the court found that the employee's conventional job knowledge and skill without more would not constitute a legitimate business interest worth safeguarding. And so oftentimes when you're bringing an injunction motion, the client will push back and say, yeah, we have a contract, that's all, you know, that's all we need, and go and get that injunction. But there's a lot more to it than that. The courts are requiring, you know, affidavits, declarations from the business people that really show what the legitimate business interest is in justifying this non-compete. You know, particularly since you have this, you know, this movement of non-compete reform, you have jurisdictions like Massachusetts that are actually entertaining that reform, particularly your judge, depending upon where they're at on the political spectrum. You really, if you to have a buttoned up case, you're going to need to have those strong declarations that demonstrate what the legitimate business interest is. And it can't just be, you know, competition. It's got to be, you know, to protect specialized training, it's got to be to protect trade secrets, confidential information. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Josh Salinas, who's going to track some of the most significant computer fraud cases that came up this year.
Right, thanks, Robert. We've continued to see developments in Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, other state computer fraud laws. Notably, with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, there's been a widening in the circuit split regarding what constitutes authorization, what constitutes unauthorized access by an employee. A few notable cases. Actually, before we go into it, I have the CLE code for you guys. The code is SS, as in Cipher Shaw, 2987. That's SS, as in Cipher Shaw, 2987. And so going to the computer fraud cases, as we discussed, kind of the issue of what constitutes authorization is constantly kind of being litigated. Certain courts, especially in the Ninth Circuit, have taken more of a narrow interpretation, a narrow approach, and found that, in general, if employees are given access, the mere breach of a policy or a computer use agreement may not necessarily constitute a violation of the CFAA, and that is under the narrow approach. An example of that similar narrow approach was in a District of Kansas case, Tank Connection versus Height. In there, the court found that the defendant was authorized to access the company's shared files, and thus did not violate the CFAA. In the United States versus Nozal case, which has been closely followed the last couple years, particularly that was one of the notable CFA cases in the Ninth Circuit regarding a former employee who allegedly used some then-current employees to access some company information. In this, the court actually affirmed the conviction of the employee and stated that using a password shared by an authorized system user to circumvent the revocation of a former employee's access is a crime. So it did provide some clarifications of kind of the circumvention of technological measures or using another employee's password. Kind of on a related note, which also discussed the circumvention of technological measures, was the Facebook versus Power Ventures case, which is a decision was issued the same month by the Ninth Circuit. And in that case, the court found that the defendant did not violate the CFAA when it extracted data from the website after receiving a cease and desist letter from the social media provider. In that case, Power Ventures had allegedly used some software technology to copy and essentially download or scrub data from users' social media websites and their Facebook profiles, and that way they could access different information and in one place. And the court actually found that Power Ventures in that case did not violate the CFAA and that the users had provided permission to access that. And one of the notable decisions we've seen, especially with California turning to form selection choice of law issues, California enacted the California Labor Code 925. And what that actually does is it restrains the ability of employers to require employees to litigate or arbitrate employee disputes both outside of California or under the laws of another state. This was generally in response to concerns that companies were using form selection clauses, choice of law provisions to circumvent or avoid California law, California public policies, including, for example, restrictive covenants with California as a fundamental policy against the use of restrictive covenants that restrict an employee's pursuit of the profession or trade. And so this is actually a pretty notable and significant piece of legislation. It's really essentially overly broad, and California is one of the first states to employ such a restriction. One of the things that it does apply to is the agreements have to be either entered into, modified, or extended on or about January 1st, 2017. So it does concern new agreements going forward. The courts have generally recognized, especially federal courts, the freedom of contract and the ability to agree to venue to choice of law provisions. And California has taken this strong stance to prevent the litigation of disputes outside of the state or outside of its laws to protect its residents. While this legislation does seem relatively somewhat straightforward, there are a lot of issues that need to be litigated. One of the concerns is the language applies to employees that primarily reside or work in California. So what that actually means of, you know, when is an employee primarily residing or living and working in California is likely going to be addressed in upcoming cases. One of the things that the statute also does provide is the employee has the right to void a provision that requires litigation of its dispute outside of California or laws that do not have a substantial protection of California law. And so not only does it provide that relief, but the court can also issue injunctive relief and may award reasonable attorney's fees for the employee enforcing his or her rights under this section. We've seen generally federal courts continue enforce formal selection clauses in restrictive covenant agreements, especially after the Supreme Court's case in Atlantic Marine. We anticipate that California's Labor Code Section 925 will likely have a significant impact on cases that involve these venue and choice of law provisions outside of California. The next thing we've seen is security breaches and data theft continue to be prevalent. This last year was north of a record year for actual data and security breaches. One of the probably most notable was the Democratic National Committee's emails were purportedly leaked. But it's unfortunate now that technology has become so prevalent that data has had some increased security concerns, and the Identity Theft Resource Center actually noted and tracks these data breaches, found that in the last year there was a 40% increase in data breaches since 2015 with a total number of over 1,000 data breaches. And so especially with employers as a concern for the protection of their information, we've seen that price social engineering has become one of the most common methods of cause for data breaches, of leaks and information theft. And so what companies can actually do and what they can learn from this is they need to alert and train their employees on following company network or computer policies, spotting potential social engineering attacks. And companies really need to have a clear method to escalate potential security risk. And so we've seen with employee awareness coupled with technological changes for the better security will reduce risk and potential exposure to liability. We actually did a webinar this past year on some of the cybersecurity concerns for attorneys and law firms, and so that can be accessed through our blog website. And then lastly, one of the significant, I guess, developments and probably more of an affirmation of trade secret protection was the ICC's extraterritorial authority in trade secret disputes regarding a denial of a petition for writ for the Supreme Court in the case Sino Legend versus ITC. The ICC has extraterritorial authority in trade secret disputes, and actually this case, it involved the misappropriation of trade secrets that had occurred abroad in China, and the U.S. Supreme Court was asked to decide whether Section 337 of the Tariff Act does actually authorize the ITC to investigate misappropriation that occurred entirely outside of the U.S. The crux of Sino Legend's argument in this case was that for the statute to apply abroad, there needs to be this express congressional intent. And not surprisingly, Sino Legend argued that that intent was actually missing from Section 337 of the Tariff Act. This was related to a prior Federal Circuit decision in the case Tianrui Group versus the ITC. In that prior case, the Federal Circuit held that such intent was manifest in the express inclusion of the phrase, the importation of articles into the United States, which had evidence that Congress had more than domestic concerns in mind. And so about a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court denied Sino Legend's petition for writ of cert. And what actually this means is that, you know, it keeps the ITC's doors open for trade secret holders who are seeking a remedy for misappropriation that is occurring abroad. And we've briefly highlighted some of our guides that we've prepared. One, we did prepare a reference guide under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. It highlights some of the unique provisions, has some further clarifications, and also has some strategies of what companies and employers can do going forward to protect themselves, protect their trade secrets, but also to have the full remedies available under the new statute. And as Robert had previously mentioned, we do have an annual 50-state desktop reference that highlights the different provisions, restrictive covenants, states that apply blue pencil or red pencil. And that actually was, I believe, highlighted and acknowledged by the Obama administration's trade secret or their call to reform for non-competes. And then we are continuing to highlight the latest developments and trends on trade secret law, restrictive covenants, computer fraud law. And so you can subscribe to our blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com.
Thanks, Josh. So with that, we do have a few questions. I think this is probably a good time to sort of summarize our our predictions for this coming year. We're already beginning to see lots of litigation. I think companies are, aggressively, pursuing non-compete claims and trade secret claims. Just seems to be a lot of new lawsuits coming about. So that's one thing we're seeing. We're seeing more and more of the DTSA claims, the claims in federal court. And so what does that mean for you and for employers? I think, you know, where we see the cases go off the tracks is where there's a lot of reactionary aspects to it, and where, you know, companies don't have, you know, proactive procedures in place. And what I mean by that is make sure you're doing exit interviews, make sure you have procedures in place about what happens when the employee leaves and getting their computers back. And if you think that this person is a competitive risk, you know, preserving their emails and perhaps having their computer imaged just in case it turns out later that it's going to be you know, an issue. The other thing that you can do is, and this is really important with all the changes in the non-compete laws, is make sure that your agreements are up to speed and that they are, you know, the latest and greatest as it relates to non-competes, so that you're in a power position if your management later tells you, you know, we got to enforce these covenants, we got to go after this person, so that you have an agreement that's up to date and not outdated. And you're going to also want to consider, you know, putting in that DTSA whistleblower language. And I think that's going to be a you know, something that's going to come up in the new year, as far as more employers and more employees trying to avail themselves of a whistleblower type defense. You know, that they took the information because they wanted to report government wrongdoing. And then lastly, I think, you know, at the tail end of the Obama administration, you saw lots of activity on all these issues, a lot of very pro-employee type of agenda. It'll be interesting to see, to the extent that is rolled back, how active the NLRB is going to be on scrutinizing non-disclosure covenants, how active the DOJ is going to be on, you know, policing no-hire type provisions. Certainly, it's the review of non-competes by the state and federal courts, you know, that those issues are going to remain. And I think a lot of times it depends upon, you know, the existing authorities in the jurisdiction, as well as the, you know, the political tendencies of the judge. Michael, I want to throw it over to you as far as predictions that you see for this year as well.
Well, it seems to me that in the first few days of the new administration here, there are fairly a lot of activity going on, and there are a fair number of pundits that can tell you, I suppose, both ways what they think are going to happen. But I think one thing seems to be clear is that there is definitely I'll call it a less regulation, more pro-business bent coming out recently. And with that may be a marked change from what Robert just mentioned was going on in the late days of the Obama administration. So if that's an accurate statement with regard to a lot of pro-business, less regulation activity, it is possible that the importance of non-compete trade secrets will be more prevalent because certainly businesses are concerned about protecting the investments they've made in trade secrets, in secret formulas, and manufacturing strategies, processes, all those sorts of things. And so if that's the case, then it could result in more litigation, making the need for having good agreements, practices, procedures in place to protect assets. So that's probably the only thing that we might be able to say or predict. But you know, who knows? If we predicted everything correctly, then we'd probably be stockbrokers and pick stocks and not be lawyers. But in any event, I think you'll potentially see more protection of business assets going forward if this apparent less regulation, pro-business bent is that's seemingly going on continues. The next thing I'd just like to say is we've got a number of questions that have been brought to our attention. We've tried to answer some of those during the presentation already. There's one more question here asking about if someone doesn't take information, and I'm paraphrasing, but if someone doesn't take information, they simply delete the information, such as emails, contracts, other electronic information, and it's not recoverable, is that actionable? And it's possible. That would be something that would be covered by the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And you know, the statute has various requirements as to what exactly is required as far as what types of activities, the level of damages, you know, what was done exactly. But the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act does address a situation where someone goes in and destroys information, and if you incur over $5,000 of damages, and that could be satisfied by the damage as a result of actually the information missing, or it could be satisfied by efforts undertaken to repair, recover the information. And I'm simplifying that, but that statute may provide recourse with regard to someone who's destroyed information that may not be recoverable. I think we've answered everything else, the other questions that we've been asked. So we see that it's the top of the hour. And thank you very much for your time today. If you have any further questions, please feel free to email or call Josh or Robert or myself. We're happy to be a resource. We're happy to assist. And I think, as was mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, we will make the presentation and PowerPoint materials available within the coming days. And also, as I think it's been mentioned before, look at our blog, tradesecretslaw.com, award-winning blog. We try to be very relevant and try to be timely and provide information throughout the United States with regard to this area. You can also go there to find out when our next upcoming webinars are, get year-in-review materials, look at old webinars and a searchable blog with articles and information regarding all the developments in this area of law. So again, we thank you for your time and look forward to attending future webinars.
Thank you very much. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.